Hey everyone, I'm your host Tom Shaughnessy and welcome back to Chain Reaction, a research-driven podcast that's a part of Delphi Digital. If you're not on Delphi's research portal, you're missing out on the critical analysis read by the top minds in the crypto space, so be sure to check it out. One quick housekeeping item, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. I may personally hold tokens mentioned on the podcast, and you can view our show notes below for our complete disclosures. With that, let's jump into the episode.
Hi everyone, I'm Jonathan Erlich. I'm an analyst at Delphi Digital, and I'm really excited to be hosting Dokwon today. Dokwon is the CEO and co-founder of Terraform Labs, the company behind Terra, Anchor, Mirror, and BossLink. So yeah, really nice to have you on, though. Thanks.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, so before getting into all things Terra, I would love to learn more about your background and how you got into crypto.
Yeah, so I studied, you know, CS at Stanford, and I used to be a NLP engineer at Microsoft for a while. And then after that, I went into the startup space. And then prior to founding Terra, I used to run a Wi-Fi direct mesh networking startup called AnyFi. So we offered sort of full stack enterprise networking solutions for large venues like amusement parks, airports, like retail locations, and so on and so forth. So how the technology worked is that user devices like users' phones and then laptops would connect to each other via Wi-Fi or Bluetooth. So the idea was that even if you don't have direct access to a Wi-Fi access point or LTE, you would still be able to connect to the internet through networks of other people. So, you know, building that network is really interesting because you sort of need to think through things like how to route packets on a network where all the users are highly mobile. So I did that for a while. And then towards end of 2016 or so, like a friend of mine randomly invited me to this Facebook chat that had 8 people. And then they were talking about, Ethereum and Monero and some interesting things like that. And then I just, you know, started to Google these keywords to see what they were, and then found that to be really interesting. So, you know, spent a lot of time in 2016-17 reading white papers, you know, getting into heated debates about protocols of the various people until I finally decided to work on crypto full time towards the end of 2017.
That's nice, man. That's nice. So I love listening to this, getting into crypto stories. So getting into Terra now, I wanted to begin picking your brain about what Terra is, because for me, it's a completely different beast from any other crypto project in the sense that it's a stablecoin system in one side, but it's also a platform for apps to be built on top of on the other side. So I wanted to get your take on what Terra is, how you define it, and also curious if that sort of understanding of what Terra is has changed across time.
You know, I don't do too much of this anymore, but when I was first getting into crypto, one of the things that really struck me about different crypto projects is that, because if you look at Monero, for instance, the technology is very fascinating, right? Or for a lot of the layer ones, you know, from a developer's perspective, there are lots of things that are happening that are very, very cool. But even sort of looking into DeFi now, and this was particularly much, much more true in 2017, is that most of the projects that are being created in crypto look inwards, which means that there's already users that are interacting with lots of different crypto projects or exchanges or trading and different things like that. So a lot of the use cases are geared towards making these things easier. So in 2017, you know, they didn't even try to do that. So, you know, most were kind of scams, but now there's a lot of interesting things that are coming up. But in terms of DeFi, like all the use cases are sort of looking inwards. But the way that I thought about it was that there aren't enough people trying to bring crypto outwards, right? Given, you know, and it takes longer to educate people that don't know anything about crypto. It could be less rewarding in the short term. But at the end of the day, if we don't find a way to sort of efficiently allocate capital to bring in millions of users to benefit from crypto networks in a way that they can't get from traditional finance, then all of this is for nothing, right? If we sort of keep this as sort of like an incestuous pool of like 200,000 users that are all trading coins with each other, then crypto is never going to go anywhere, right? So that's sort of like the founding premise behind Terra. And then largely over the last 3 years, nothing has changed. So I think Terra is unique in the sense that we sort of tried to think about, you know, what makes money the way it is. And then we tried to think about money as a product. And then everything that the company does is various products like Mirror, Anchor, Chai, tries to come up with ways to enhance the features of this new money to make our stablecoins more useful.
I love that, man. I love that. And it's certainly like, you certainly notice that, for example, for me, it's clear that Terraform Labs is sort of one of the most sort of outward looking teams in crypto, and sort of it's one of those teams looking to bring sort of the mainstream into crypto and sort of develop crypto-based solutions for a mainstream audience. So man, getting into like at the heart of Terra, there's your stablecoin mechanism. And I would like to explore it with you. It now backs more than 200 million in assets in USD and Korean won. I would like for you to explain it and how it works and how our apps currently using it.
Sure. So right now we have about four different stablecoins that are live. There is UST, Terra UST, that's pegged to the dollar, currently at about $185 million market cap, most of which is in Mirror, by the way. And then CaroT, which is the Korean won peg stablecoin, currently, I think, close to $100 million in market cap, most of that coming through payment applications in Korea. MNT, tagged to the Mongolian national currency, and SDT, pegged to the IMF SDR. There's about 10 other fiat currencies coming. Most of these are in the top 10 of fiatmarketcap.com. So basically how the ecosystem works is that you have all of these different stable coins that are each pegged to different fiat currencies. They can each be swapped with each other with a simple transaction, paying a flat fee of 25 basis points. How each of these stable coins remain stability is that there is an ecosystem token called Luna that absorbs the volatility in the price and supply of the stable coins. So for example, if Terra USD, for instance, is trading at, let's say, 90 cents, the protocol guarantees that the price of Terra USD is going to return to normalcy by agreeing to swap one Terra USD for $1 worth of Luna at any given time. So what this means is that if Terra USD is trading for 90 cents, users can buy up Terra USD from the market and then swap it for $1 worth of Luna and then sell it in the open market for $1. So that sort of price pegging mechanism constantly creates arbitrage pressures to sell the currency if it's trading above $1 and to buy up the currency if it's trading below.
That's really interesting, man. And I'm curious, how have you seen sort of the system working in the wild? And if you have seen like the pegs from sort of the peg, and how have you solved that?
Yeah, so I think up until now, you know, Terra USD and KRT aren't really used for speculative trading purposes. So in some sense, like if you have retail payments users that are sort of interacting with the currency, they're not acclimated to, you know, speculating on whether stablecoins are going to keep its price. If you tell them it's going to be worth a Korean won, they're going to think it's going to be worth a Korean won. So there's been less threats to the peg. It's been very recently when the peg has been put to serious test with the kimchi premium. So kimchi premium is a concept whereby crypto assets in Korea are trading at significant premium to global average due to capital controls. And then 2017, it was crazy with Bitcoin trading almost twice the price in Korea as it was trading everywhere else. But today, it's around 5 to 6% premium to global prices. So what that means is there's been an arbitrage corridor for people to buy KRT, swap it into US Terra, and then sell it on, let's say, KuCoin or several DEXs to be able to buy up crypto assets on the cheap and then to create that arbitrage. So that has seen significant volume sort of cycle into Terra Korean Won and then swap volumes to UST and so on and so forth. But you know, what's been kind of interesting is that there's also been like a decent amount of swap volume in and out of Luna. So, which means that arbitragers also noticing that the stability mechanism is there to normalize prices when it's getting too aggressive. So we've seen situations where, Terra KRW was trading at, some premium, let's say 5%, but it's always been brought down back again to normal levels. So I think right now it's trading at maybe like 1 to 2% premium at the moment.
Nice. Thanks. So up until now, like I think that the story of Terra like couldn't be told without talking about Chai, right? Which was the first app to be built on top of Terra. And as you said, Chai is a payment app that uses Terra, such as its payments rail. It had a massive 2020. It now boasts 50,000 monthly active users. It generates more than 1 million in daily transaction volume. And the fees generated by Chai have made Terra the third largest blockchain by fees generated. So I was curious, like, how has this process with Chai been and what do you attribute sort of Chai's success to?
So to sort of go back to Terra's mission statement, the way that we think about it is the only product that we create is the Terra stablecoin. And basically the way that we think about it is to sort of create features around this money that make our stablecoins easier to spend and more attractive to hold. So Anchor, for instance, is a savings protocol that makes yields on Terra stablecoins more attractive than what you can get in traditional banking, what you can get in other sort of DeFi protocols. So it makes it more attractive to hold. Mirror makes our stablecoins a gateway to be able to purchase any sort of asset class through synthetic price exposure. So it makes the stablecoins more useful like that. Chai's role, as well as other payment companies that we are hooked up to or we found, are intended to make our stablecoins more easier to spend. So yeah, I think we've had some interesting success with that. We're doing about $1.5 billion in sort of annualized transaction volume, activated about 2.5 million users in Korea. We've acquired a payment gateway called Einport, currently doing about $3.2 billion in volume. And traction has been decent. Cumulative fundraising, including the likes of SoftBank, $88 million. So I think it's a strong start. So the reason why I think using crypto as a payments rail is really interesting is because, you know, the interests of the people that are involved in the payment stack is intended to be adversarial against you. So for example, for a payments processor, the most profitable thing to do is to delay the settlement time as much as possible, because they can both, you know, earn like an investment interest from the money that they're custodying for you. So you can actually deploy that capital to earn returns on various different types of things. And also they're incentivized to extract as much rent as possible. But it turns out that both of these things might work in some payment contexts, but it's actually one of the greatest impediments to getting digital payments adopted in many, many different parts of the world. So for example, if you look in Japan, the average settlement time for payments is around 7 days. Southeast Asia, it's in excess of 10 days. In Korea, it's somewhere between 5 to 7 days at this point. And the interesting thing is that if you are an SMB, right, or if you are, let's say, a restaurant, or if you're a cab driver, you can't wait several days in order for your payments to be settled to you. If you're a cab driver, you need that money, you need your fares right away in order to be able to buy fuel for next day's rides and to be able to put food on your family's table, right? So that's why if you go to places like Singapore, if you go to Vietnam, like cash is king. Like there's not that many cabs that will take credit cards, right? So, but if you are able to vastly speed up the settlement process by which money reaches the merchants, then in that case, that's a game changer. because it means that you can get a payments process right away, while at the same time preserving a lot of the benefits of digital payments, like nobody can steal your money, you know, your money can't be damaged, accounting is easier, and so on and so forth. So the Terra blockchain, so Terra payments can settle to users in 6 seconds, which is the average block time of the Terra blockchain, as opposed to having to wait several days in order for payments to be settled to you. So in sort of like a brutally competitive e-commerce setting, as in Korea, whereas like it's more than $100 billion in GMV across all the different e-commerce sectors, making one of the largest e-commerce markets in the world, but it's also highly competitive. So you have a lot of platforms and e-commerce merchants wanting to get as settled as fast as possible. And I think our initial product market fit largely came from that, in the sense that merchants saw a greater value proposition in both in terms of reduced fees and fast settlement times than anything else that they can get from traditional payment services.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. So it's reduced fees and they get their money basically instantly, right? And right. I'm curious, how's the UX from the merchant perspective? Like, what do they do with their crypto? How do they turn it into Korean won? And what happens there?
Yeah, so in the beginning, it was very bespoke. So when we had just Timon, one of the merchants, and like maybe Anurja, it was basically like a very manual coordination between our finance team and theirs. So it was like, yeah, kind of like everybody trying to figure out how to do XYZ. So like the app looks sleek in the front end, but admittedly, like in the back end, it was total shit show. Like there's a lot of handholding that needed to be done. Now we have more of a, you know, sleek admin interface where merchants can hook up to it, you know, manage their assets, settle out the fiat if they choose to. So we're starting to build like a settlement rails on top of this that can actually be turned into a product. So which makes it much, much easier to integrate with lots of different merchants. And in terms of like total merchants, we're above 50 at this point. So we definitely needed to have this in order to scale.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And I imagine like the vision for the future is that they, at some point, they just trust KRT so much that they just keep it, right?
Yeah. So interestingly, this is sort of how Alibaba went about it. So in the beginning, when Chinese merchants received payments over Alipay, in order to be able to hook up to the remainder of their supply chain, they had to cycle out to renminbi, which means that, like, for example, like if you're a restaurant, you can't pay with Alipay to your vendor, right? Where you couldn't 5 years ago. But what Ant Financial has been doing over the last, 5 years or so is that they've been sort of hooking up into a B2B pipeline such that that even in a B2B context, people don't have to leave the Ant Financial ecosystem. So you can settle to merchants or hook up to the supply chain in sort of Alipay points, if you will, which is amazing, which means that in some sense, Ant Financial at this point represents a digitized version of the Chinese yuan, right? Which makes it a very easy on-ramp for CBDCs as they're coming up. But I think the way that we aspire in the sort of the Terra Chai ecosystem is pretty much the same. So we want to be able to build that sort of ecosystem, whereas where like by hooking up deeply and deeply, more deeply into the entire commerce stack, we're able to use KRT as a means of denominating our currencies in a way that KRW cannot.
That's awesome. That's awesome. That's awesome. And man, can you comment on how sort of like Chai generates a lot of fees for Terra, right? Transaction fees. But there's like another side of the story in which Chai also benefits Terra from seniorage, right? Could you comment on how that works and sort of also in the context of all the other apps that are being built on top of Terra?
Sure. So if you look at sort of two pillars of economic policy in any sort of fiat money context, there's monetary policy, which controls the supply of money to achieve economic goals. And then there's fiscal policy, which dictates government spending. And this includes things like subsidies and you know, direct government spending to be able to achieve social goals as well as economic goals. So the interesting thing about blockchains is that they aspire to be a monetary policy for everyone. And then they have generally, to some extent, have to varying degrees a robust monetary policy. So if you look at most crypto researchers and economists, they spend a lot of time thinking about the monetary policy, but really only a handful of projects think about a fiscal policy, which means how do you come up with systems whereby you sort of achieve, you know, social justice or at least developer efficiency by coming up with a way for the community to think about how to allocate funds to different types of things. So the fiscal policy in Terra is pretty simple. So every time that a new unit of Terra is minted, like a portion of those goes into a community pool that is governed by, you know, governed by a set of Luna stakeholders. So in the beginning, we didn't have this governance module. So we had a system whereby as new Terra was being minted, like a portion of those, you know, those funds were being burned and a portion of those funds were being kept to fund dApps like Chai so that they can do interesting things for users. And most of those benefits came in the form of promotions. In the very beginning days of the network, given that the supply of KRT was zero, seniors was massive, like lots of amounts of KRT was being printed. And the promotions back in those days correspondingly was very, very large. And now we're sort of transitioning more into a DAO model where the community funds can be voted on by various different people in the ecosystem. So it's already been implemented. And as more currencies start to enter the cycle, there will be more seniors that will go into different DApps. And as an interesting story, we're also sort of transitioning to an overall DAO model as well, where we're putting a significant chunk of Luna into like the community pool such that like more than just the stable coins that are entering circulation, people will be able to vote on how to spend the allocation of Luna that was previously held by Terraform Labs as well.
Oh, I love that, man. So the Luna is basically the senior edge, or does it correspond to something else?
That's more of like, before we were cutting a lot of grants directly from Terraform Labs. So, you know, in 2020, we like issued a lot of grants. And then we also invested in a few projects that were strategically beneficial to the Terra ecosystem. But more and more that as we do this, it seems to make things faster and lead to better judgment to have the community be the decider of how the funds should be allocated. So it gives both, you know, greater transparency. So if everything is on chain and then everything is up for public discussion, then you can have a healthier debate and more transparency around how the funds are spent. And B, you just have so much more ecosystem support behind it.
That's really nice. That's really nice. So man, to close on Chai, I wanted to sort of circle back and talk and touch sort of on three recent announcements you made around Chai. The first one was you raised a $60 million Series B round. So I wanted to know like basically what those funds are gonna be used for and sort of what's the play there.
Sure. So the raise number was kind of tricky because there was, you know, exchange rates between Korean won and USD, and some investors wired in USD, some investors wired in KRW. The figure is a little bit closer to 70. So the Series B brings Chai's cumulative funding up to $88 million. So the use of these proceeds are fairly simple, and it can be largely divided up into three buckets. So number one is geographic expansion. So you know, we've sort of kept this on the down low, but we've started to set up a growth team in Singapore that is headed by, you know, this guy called Rahul. So he's the head of strategy, the former head of strategy for Uber APAC. So he was sort of like the guy that wrote a lot of the playbooks on how Uber entered different markets and in Asia and sort of saw them wind down as well. So I think it's a great fit for something like us because we need to write a playbook into entering other different markets as well as fast as possible. We've also set up an engineering office in India. And the goal is that would sort of be the, you know, sort of be handling the growth side of our business, such as doing forward integrations, localizing the app into lots of different settings. So you can expect to see, you know, Chai enter different markets in 2021, powered by the Series B. The second is we're starting to variegate our offerings to merchants to make Chai even more attractive besides just fast settlements. So some of the things that we're doing is, for example, really putting the gears on the Chai card. And why the Chai card is really interesting is because of this feature called Boost. So how Boost works is that every time that a user makes a transaction, he earns like a different point. It's called Bolts. And then once you accumulate enough Bolts, there's a page in the app where you can cycle through the various different types of promotions. And then like you can turn on like a specific promotion that you would like to use Bolts on. And the reason why this is interesting is that every day Chai users are logging into the Chai app to figure out and see all the different types of promotions that are available. And this creates a discovery funnel for merchants that are looking to offer promotions on the Chai app in order to get a brand exposure and revenue lift for their sales. And this is kind of huge, right? It's basically like sort of a Rakuten's Ebates or the Honey sort of model, whereby you create a marketing forefront for merchants to be able to get revenue lift on inventory that they can't clear. So it's one of the things that we're doing. We're also looking into doing things like revenue-based financing, whereas merchants can take out loans, you know, simply on the basis of their transaction history with Chai, without having to submit, you know, complicated paperwork or have to visit like bank branches or anything like that. So it's very similar to, let's say, Stripe Capital, its analog in the US. And the last thing is just to pay for operations as we're growing in headcount.
That's really nice, man. It's really, really excited for Chai in 2021 and its expansion. It's really cool. So the other like announcement you made recently was one, the acquisition of Import, which you touched upon. It's a large payments aggregator in Korea, and also the integration with Samsung Pay. Just wanted to know like sort of how you're thinking, what's going on there?
Sure. So iImport is it's been around for a while. So it launched in 2011, and basically it's very similar to Stripe in the US. So they offer integration SDKs in I think over 10 programming languages, supporting most of the payment options. So there's very little payments fragmentation in the US, but in Korea and most of Asia for that matter, there's like hundreds and hundreds of different e-wallets, right? So basically every large corporation has their own payment module, and then it's very hard to offer support for all of these different things. And so in some sense, like Stripe's value proposition is even greater in Asia than it is in the US. So what iImport does is that it offers support for 10 plus integration SDKs, and then it supports all of the different payment options. It supports Chai, it supports KakaoPay, it supports Toss, supports PayCo, supports all the credit cards. So by writing just a few lines of code for a merchant, it becomes very trivial to integrate like a payments module directly into their app. So starting from 2011, it was quite small, but today it's doing so we closed the year with about $3.2 billion in transaction volume. We think we can get it to hit $7 billion by the end of the year. So what's kind of interesting is the iImport team was only 5 people when we acquired them. So that's fantastic, right? Because and they're all developers. So they didn't have a single salesperson on the team while running a B2B sales business. Specifically to how iImport helps Terra and Chai is that it sort of becomes like a merchant acquisition network for the Chai payment system. Right. So what that means is iImport currently services around 1,700 merchants. And even though it offers the ability to support lots of different payment options on its plugin, it can also do this. So number one, we can hit up the merchants in iImport's network to prioritize Chai in their checkout flow. And number two, and sort of like the interfaces that work with iImport, we can own the checkout page, if you will. So to prioritize Chai as offering lower payments, lower payment fees than any other option in the stack. So these are like really interesting ways in which we can sort of put rocket fuel to Chai's growth in a way that would have taken a lot longer to do independently. Okay, so Samsung Pay is the largest payment service in Korea. So Samsung, which is, they make phones, that's a Korean company. It's actually the largest Korean company. I think they're responsible for about 30-35% of GDP. So naturally, unless like, I don't know, like you're really into Instagram or something, most Korean people have Samsung Galaxy phones. And the thing is, just by adding your card into Samsung Pay, you can easily, tap your phone against, like a POS machine. And it's built natively in. So like everybody uses Samsung Pay. You know, obviously it does tens of billions of dollars in transaction volume annually. So what Chai has done is that it's added the Chai card to be supported in Samsung Pay. And generally they do have, support for a lot of the larger bank-backed credit cards and debit cards. But in terms of like the cards that have come from like fintech companies, they don't really have too much support for that. So what's kind of interesting is that Chai, by being added into an option into Samsung Pay, it can easily hook up to the entire long term of, millions and millions of different merchants that otherwise would have taken us a long time to physically visit and sign contracts for. So Chai has always had sort of a head-based strategy where we tackle the largest e-commerce merchants and get them integrated. Hooking up to Samsung Pay means that we can get access to long tail without having to do direct sales. So it's truly meaningful, and I think it, in a lot of ways, a game changer.
Amazing, man. That's amazing. Really excited for Chai in 2021 and beyond.
So, yeah.
Man,
yeah.
Switching gears a little bit here, I want to start talking about Mirror and Anchor and the new sort of announcements. But before doing that, I wanted to touch on one key piece of infrastructure that I think is what's enabled all of this innovation to happen, which is smart contracts, right? You recently launched smart contracts capabilities for Terra. So I wanted to get like your take on that. How important is that for Terra?
Yeah, so for context, in late 2020, we added support for a smart contract engine called Cosmosm, which is developed by the Conpio team, ex-developers in core developers in Cosmos. It's been really interesting. So how Cosmosm works is that it's a wrapper around the Wasmer runtime, so WebAssembly, and then can support any sort of smart contracts that target, let's say, WebAssembly runtime. So technically, with a few or more wrappers, you can support smart contracts in JavaScript, support Rust, support Go, and then so on and so forth. So this is a very generalized type of engine that's been battle tested in lots of different contexts outside of blockchains as well. So the reason why the addition of smart contracts becomes very, very interesting is that it hasn't been that easy to build things on top of Terra before. You could use the stablecoins for transactional purposes or to create centralized services on top of these stablecoins. But it hasn't been easy to build things natively on top of this infrastructure to be able to do anything that you want in a trustless kind of way. And the addition of Cosmosm definitely accomplishes that. So it's allowed us to create the core pieces of infrastructure that is a Mirror and Anchor, but we're also starting to see a lot of third-party teams start to build things on top of our infrastructure, most recently around Mirror, and there's plenty of reasons why that's attractive to do.
Oh, that's really nice, man. That's really nice. Can you share like what teams are building and sort of like what has been the response from developers and what kind of response you've seen until now?
Yeah, so the response to maybe it's easier to talk about why Mirror is exciting, and then to sort of talk about ways in which developers are happy to build things on top of it. So, but for Mirror, it's basically a synthetics protocol that allows there to be a synthetic token for any type of asset. So there can be a token that tracks the price of an Apple stock, like a token that tracks the price of, let's say, a piece of real estate, a token that tracks the price of, let's say, the volatility of staking rewards. So like the possibilities are endless insofar as the asset has a continuous price signal. It's very easy to do. Now, the assets that are live today are 13 of the most attractive equities in the market. There's a proposal to add about 40 more into the set. And what this means is that you can use these synthetic stocks for users anywhere across the world to buy price exposure into US equities in a truly permissionless fashion without time restrictions. So you can trade this 24/7, fractional ownership. So you don't have to buy the entire stock. You can buy up to a millionth of the stock. And you can do this in a purely pseudonymous kind of way. Like you don't have to reveal any of your identity as you're making the purchase. Now, some people say, hey, like when Bitcoin and Ethereum are ripping the way that they do, like equities as an asset class isn't all that interesting, is it? Right. But that's not the point, right? The point is that Mirror becomes an infrastructure where you allow people to synthesize anything. And if you see the rise of stablecoins such as Tether, USDC, Terra, it's just that it's not so much that people want an additional dollar by sacrificing a dollar when they purchase a Tether stablecoin. They like to be able to do things with a dollar in a crypto-specific context. And that's why stablecoins have done really well. And in some sense, the stablecoin is a synthetic of the US dollar, right? And if you sort of expand that solution space such that anything can be synthesized, then that's a total game changer. It means that instead of having to build DeFi on primitives that are just useless food coins, it means that you can actually bridge and start to bring lots of external world value on chain in a synthetic context and to build truly meaningful pieces of infrastructure on top of that. So how more interesting would Compound be when you can leverage on, let's say, equities, leverage on things like, you know, real estate, instead of leveraging on, let's say, I don't know, Pickle or like, you know, there's probably like a burrito coin or something like that. You know, that's just, you know, way more interesting, right? And it's not to say that these coins are useless. I am. No. I'm not saying that these coins are useless, but the thing is, there is significant value to be said for bringing lots of assets on chain as well. So now on to some of the projects that are being built. So the things that you can build on Mirror are sort of obvious, right? So there's a group of people that are looking into how to support pre-IPO contracts on top of Mirror. So for example, like brought this about was the Coinbase listing that is slated to go on like Q1, Q2 of this year. So that's kind of interesting. There is also like a team that is setting up to build social trading on top of Mirror, which means that a trading professional can declare like a trading strategy on top of Mirror. And then the smart contracts that are watching this smart contract replicates the trading strategy of the master contract. And then in exchange, a portion of the profits goes to the master contract in exchange for providing this sort of valuable service. And all of these different projects that are launching on top of Mirror, you know, we're sort of steering them towards applying for a grant from the community fund once they have, they're living more ready to share their plans. So it's going to be both transparent, and then the decision of whether to fund them is going to be community driven.
Cool, man. Cool. So talking about Mirror now, like there's already competition, like in the traditional space. You talked about it, like Robinhood and eToro, but there's also competition from the crypto in crypto with, for example, synthetics or FTX. So I wanted to get your take about sort of what the competitive advantages of Mirror are and how do you see Mirror winning here?
Sure. So there's a lot of exchanges that have started to dabble into, you know, like the stock space. Bitfinex offered Tether settled, ETF futures. So mainly, I think the S&P 500, they plan to touch single stocks soon. You know, Bittrex recently did something similar. They started to offer lots and lots of different single stocks on Bittrex Global. FTX obviously did something very similar. But I think the real promise of this is that, we allow you to buy stocks with Bitcoin. I don't think that's the point. It's just that because they're centralized, they can't be issued as decentralized assets that can be composed into different things. And once you can't have that, there's no point of this. Except that, like, you sort of save the on-ramp problem for people that are native to crypto. And it harkens back to what I said before about a lot of the crypto infrastructure and products looking inwards, trying to offer products that makes it easier for crypto people to do things and trade assets. But the real goal here is to build cool things that offer a value proposition to millions and millions of users outside of crypto that finds real value to come in. And I think that's the core differentiation with Mirror. It's not its goal isn't to allow people to buy stocks with Bitcoin, which is looking inwards. But the goal is to allow people that currently don't have quality access to be able to purchase it, A, and B, for different derivatives and products on top of Mirror to be built in a way that simply can't exist in traditional finance.
Totally, totally. Like DeFi allows sort of these synthetics to get superpowers, right? To get sort of abilities right. That you don't see sort of in the traditional space. I liked a lot sort of the idea of having yield-bearing stocks and also the idea of sort of having all sorts of crazy indexes be created when sort of these synthetics products mature. So really excited about that. Now, I want to talk about value accrual in Mirror. So Mirror sort of launched the Mirror token. It fairly launched. And sort of the way in which the fee mechanism works is right now, users basically pay 1.5% fee whenever they close a CDP, right? So like the way I see it, it sort of incentivizes opening CDPs, but disincentivizes closing CDPs, which in that sense sort of prioritizes growth at this point in the protocol rather than value accrual for the Mirror token, right? I wanted to sort of have your take on that and sort of like sort of what's behind the decision of sort of that fee mechanism behind Mirror.
Sure. So in order for the easiest way to think about how Mirror captures value from its various synthetics is to charge a transaction or trading fee. And this is the decision that synthetics made. So if you look at the various synths that are trading on the synthetics platform, it's in sort of like a closed off internal exchange. So all the synths can be traded at each other at a fixed spread, right? And then every time that a synth is being traded, like a small fee is charged, which benefits SNX holders. So the main benefit of this is twofold. Like number one, like you can have greater liquidity, at least internal to the exchange. And number two, you are able to charge fees on this exchange. But the downsides of this is that you can't have these assets be separated out and then trade on various different DeFi protocols and projects, right? Because in that case, the rent extraction model becomes broken, mm-hmm. right? And we made a conscious choice to recognize that if the mirrored assets were to do really well, we cannot control the manner in which they're wrapped and traded. So mirrored assets could end up in a centralized exchange, like, for example, Binance, for instance, right? And in which case, like, we wouldn't be able to control fees from how these assets are being traded anyway. Or if it crosses a bridge into Solana's Serum, for instance, or Ethereum's Uniswap, then in that case, that's not like a fee extraction model that we can control, right? What we can control is when these assets are minted and redeemed, which happens natively on the Mirror protocol on the Terra chain. And we decided that in order to allow as many of these M assets to be minted as possible, it's good for the initial parameter to not charge rent on the minting side, but to charge a rent on the redemption side. So how it works is that whenever a CDP is closed, a portion of the fees goes into buying back Mirror tokens from TerraSwap, and then these Mirror tokens that have and just been purchased gets distributed to people that are staking Mirror. So there's a buyback and dividend mechanism.
Yeah. That makes sense, man. That's interesting. So one of my main concerns regarding Mirror is sort of a crackdown attempt from US authorities, as it's already happened before with platforms such as Abra. I wanted to get your take on this. How concerned are you about it? And how do you see this playing out in the future?
Yeah, so for people that are coming into the Terra ecosystem for the first time as we launched Mirror, I think we're very careless with regulations, but we run a fully compliant and licensed fintech business. So we know what that game is all about, and we're fairly serious people, so we don't take it lightly. You know, sort of the decision that we made when we're first launching Mirror is for us to capture no value from it. That was a really great part of the decision, and it's not easy. Because putting developer hours and time into developing something like Mirror is not trivial. And then we have full intent to continue to support in whatever way we can as the Mirror protocol grows. But what we did is, as we were designing the protocol, we set aside no tokens for the team, no tokens for the investors. I received some Mirror tokens as a function of having my Luna stakes. But at the end of last year, I committed to give all of that away to people that actually built the protocol. So I have nothing, Terra has nothing, and we have no governance rights as a consequence of that. So this is something that we do not control, right? So even now, there's 30 different proposals that are up on governance. I think it just passed yesterday. None of those proposals were from us. It was entirely from the community, and the engagement as a consequence of being decentralized is huge. Like, it's early days of the protocol, but the way that the community is engaging with the protocol and suggesting changes and different things like that is just fabulous. And the way that I think about it is, at this point, we don't control or own any portions of the Mirror protocol. All we did was write code. And you cannot be prosecuted for what you do not control, nor did you profit from. So I think that's sort of the decision that we took. And number two, we're not really like under the US nexus. Like, for Abra, it was a bunch of US persons, with the company based in the US. So then there was a lot of issues with that. But we have no assets to seize in the US. Nor do we profit from this. So I feel pretty comfortable at it. That's where they're lures.
Thanks, man. Totally. And I love the aspect that you're sort of giving away your tokens to the people who are building the protocol. That's really nice. So, man, sort of my last question regarding Mirror is around sort of sustainability. Like, right now, sort of users are being incentivized to mint synthetic assets because of the liquidity mining campaign, right? But what do you see happening when the liquidity mining campaign ends? Like, what's going to keep people incentivized to mint assets and sort of provide them to the market?
Yeah, so I think you're exactly right that right now the mining subsidies are playing a big role in sort of the demand for assets. But the thing is, I think really what we expect the majority of the demand for assets to be driven from is new apps that are built on top of Mirror, integrations with existing services, and this sort of user farming program that we recently announced. So, for example, like, it becomes eminently, MLSs become eminently more interesting if it gets added as like a collateral to, let's say, Compound or Cream, because it means that you can lever up on different types of equities in a way that's difficult to do in a traditional finance context. Lots of countries have laws against leverage-based trading. So, offering that in a permissionless context is something that's going to have large demand for, in my opinion. So, and anybody that has held Tesla stock over the last year or two knows that if you had the option to lever up 10x, you would have done it. So, anyways, missed opportunities. Yeah. There's those things. Interesting thing that we did also when we first created Mirror is that we worked with one of the ecosystem players called Kaizenpool to develop a sort of a mobile trading interface for Mirror. It's called Mirror Wallet, available on both iOS and Android. And I think as an initial start, it's very sleek. I think it's competitive to Robinhood in terms of the user experience that can be offered. Now, the interesting thing that we plan to do with this, as well as we've already done with our web apps, is that this is going to be fully open source and encouraged to be forked. So the idea is that we just put up like a guideline on our community on how developers can fork these different types of applications and then acquire users as a consequence of that. So, for example, like, a developer in Malaysia might take the Mirror wallet, add localization, add local on-ramps, and then drive adoption for users that are looking to gain access to Mirror assets in their local jurisdiction. In that case, after he acquires, let's say, 100,000 users, he can issue a grant proposal to the community fund on-chain, and then Mirror holders can vote on whether the size of the grants and the proof that the developer offers is adequate. So basically, it's a way for developers to farm MIR tokens as a consequence of acquiring users. And it's something that's really, it's never been done in crypto before. because in crypto, you have a bunch of incentives to benefit traders or developers that issue tokens. But developers that actually issue or create applications doing the most interesting and innovative kind of work, they're always overlooked. So if you look at most of the applications that were built on top of crypto, even the ones that are helping in DeFi, which is a very hot category, a lot of them went bankrupt during the bear market. And it's because there's no sustainable business model for them to benefit from like the frothy crypto market. But this enables a business model for people that are actually bringing users into crypto, into Mirror, in a way that's never been done in crypto before. And the decision-making is entirely driven by the community and the governance procedures. So we're quite excited to see how those efforts pan out in terms of growing the adoption of mirrored assets.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that as well, man. And I agree with you that in the long term, it's like the sustainability of Mirror should be driven by sort of natural demand for these synthetic assets, right? But yeah, man, sort of moving on to another exciting topic, can you please, I know we're sort of getting out of time, but can you please talk about Anchor, which is sort of a recent announcement you made and a savings and lending protocol you're launching soon?
Yeah, so it's one of those things that people forget when they've been in crypto for a long time. But you know, no matter how well Bitcoin does over the next 10 years, it just the reality of it is that most people in the world don't invest assets. So like unless like the United States hits Zimbabwe status, everybody is going to still sort of denominate their savings and wealth in terms of the US dollar, at least for the foreseeable future. And to be honest, even if Bitcoin does well, I don't want to live in a world where the United States looks like Zimbabwe and the inflation for the dollar is that bad. So, you know, I think everyone, including people in the crypto space, is incentivized to make sure that the world doesn't burn in such a way. So anyways, like most people in the world, like denominate their savings and net worth in their national fiat currencies. And let's assume that that's going to stay the way it is for the next few years. The problem, the big problem with the macro climate today is that essentially there's no interest that you can earn on bank deposits. Like banks are offering either negative interest rates or nothing at all, which doesn't defend you against inflation. So this sort of puts the traditional banking infrastructure at significant risk. Now, on the other hand, if you look at DeFi, you have things like Compound, Aave, different types of lending protocols that are offering you yield on the dollar or stablecoins. And then you have things like EFI that earn interest from, let's say, like airdrops and liquidity farming schemes that a lot of DeFi protocols are doing. But the problem here is that, you know, at the end of the day, like the interest rates that are going to each of these positions is driven by speculation. So if you remember, you know, demand for Compound is driven by demand for people that are looking to lever up on different types of crypto assets, like Ethereum, like BAT, different things like that. So it can go high, right? So sometimes like you would see like 12% yield on Compound or like maybe 5% yield on Compound or something like that. But in most cases, it's very, very low. So you have extreme volatility in the interest rate that you can earn. But like if you put yourself in the position of like a 50-year-old farmer from Idaho, and then like you somehow figured out this amorphous way to get your dollars into stablecoins, and then like you put your thing into Compound after like going through like the whole MetaMask shit show. And then like it offers you 12% in one day. So you're pretty happy about that. But then like 3 months later, you come back and it's only earned like 0.6%. Then you are not happy about that. Because like that sort of volatility in terms of interest rates is not something that most people look forward to when they're sort of trying to plan their lives against stable savings. And this is where Anchor comes in. So the way that we think about it is that Anchor offers interest rates on stablecoin deposits, namely Terra, that is both stable and attractive. So the way that you are able to do this is that instead of tapping into demand for leverage to power interest rates, it taps into staking returns from multiple different ecosystems. So let's say Ethereum, Algorand, Terra, Cosmos, Polkadot, and so on and so forth, Solana, and so forth. So the idea is that when a user makes a deposit, a portion of those deposits are used to acquire staking positions across you know, multiple different ecosystems. And then the staking returns that accrue to those positions gets conferred to the depositor in the form of a yield. So in some sense, like you get interest rates on your stable coins that is a diversified stream of staking returns from multiple different ecosystems at the same time. And the reason why this offers more stable returns is because the monetary policy of most POS networks is fixed. So there's a fixed percentage of tokens that are being printed every year in order to power staking returns on the Anchor deposit. And this makes it fundamentally attractive, right? Because like it might fluctuate a bit, but you're not going to see, you know, like 30-40% changes in the staking rate over some period of time.
So you're going to have people that hold sort of staking assets, offer them in the platform. And you're going to have people looking for savings sort of come to the platform for interest as well, right?
That's the interesting part. So we will have that interface, but I think the most exciting thing about Anchor, the product, is that it gets packaged into a B2B savings SDK. So basically the way that we're positioning ourselves is that if Stripe's tagline was add payments to your app in 7 lines a code or less, and then they had beautiful SDKs where like it became very easy for mobile developers, fintech companies to integrate payments with the app. For Anchor, it's going to have a similar SDK, and then the tagline is going to be add savings to your app in 7 lines a code or less. So the idea is that for any sort of traditional fintech company or like a digital financial institution to be able to hook up to the Anchor SDK, to be able to offer interest on unused deposits that their user is custodying with them. So this becomes fundamentally a game changer because we're not trying to build like a bunch of crypto native interfaces on this app. We will do those things. But what becomes interesting is if, let's say, Revolut hooks up to the Anchor SDK, Chai definitely is going to hook up to the Anchor SDK, such that millions and millions of users can benefit from Anchor savings in a way that they couldn't before. That's the game changer.
That's really exciting, bringing the mainstream to crypto. I love it. I love it, man. Can you comment on sort of how development is at with regards to Anchor?
Yeah, so we finished yesterday, entered audit, sometime ago. So they started to look at the code base a little bit ahead of time. So two firms are auditing the code base at the moment. So QuantStamp, is undergoing audits, and this company called Cryptonix is also auditing. So I think the end result is going to be great. Yeah.
Oh, that's really exciting, man. That's really exciting. So man, wrapping up, like clearly Terra has a lot of stuff going on, from payments to synthetic assets to savings. Putting this all together, sort of what can we expect from Terra in 2021 and beyond, and sort of where the priorities are at right now?
So largely the two things is going to be, number one, we're going to keep doing the same thing that we've been doing. But number two, the way that we're doing it is going to change significantly. So number one, our focus is going to always be on looking outwards. So how can we bring as many people into crypto as possible? How can we offer things that are natively good about crypto and offer that and package that into a value proposition that millions of retail users can understand? That focus is going to be the same across our savings products, across our synthetics products, across our payments products. And that's going to be that's never going to change in sort of like the life cycle of the firm in Terraform Labs. The way that we're going to be running these things is going to change a little bit, though. So in the first couple of years of the project, it was very centralized in the sense that you had a few centralized businesses that were building on top of the Terra protocol, mainly as a way to get things done faster. And then you had centralized decision-making in terms of how the assets around the project was being spent and around how data was being controlled across the project. In 2021, we look forward to moving to a more community-driven model in two different types of ways. Number one, assets that are being held by the Terra projects, so mainly the Terraform Labs, which is the company that I run, is going to get decentralized into a community fund, which means that it's going to get easier for different companies to spin up in the Terra ecosystem with or without the consent or the approval of Terraform Labs, it's going to also lead to more transparency, because if you put, you know, the use of community funds up for a governance vote, then it becomes very easy for people to see and understand why decisions are being made the way they are, in a way that involves a lot more stakeholders than it did before. So in some sense, we expect information asymmetry to be reduced significantly in 2021 compared to previous years.
That's nice, man. Thanks a lot for your time. It was an amazing conversation.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.